to the Modern Federalist. Your compass in the world of politics, policy, and people. We're here to challenge norms, question narratives, and offer balanced insight on pressing issues. Your host, Charlton Allen, is a seasoned analyst and a staunch advocate for freedom. With his sharp intellect, he'll guide you through the maze of contemporary politics. Whether you're a political enthusiast or just a curious observer, you've found your haven. This is the Modern Federalist. Welcome to the revolution. The revolution.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Modern Federalist. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and we have a jam-packed agenda for you today. First up, we have an insightful conversation with Zach Smith, a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We'll be diving deep into the recent appellate bond imposed on President Donald Trump and the civil litigation pursued by the New York Attorney General against the Trump Organization for alleged fraud. Next, we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's recent opinion in Trump versus Anderson, a case that has stirred up quite a bit of conversation around ballot disqualification in Colorado. Then we'll shift gears to a thought-provoking interview with Samantha Crane, the Vice President of the Federalist Society at the University of Wisconsin School of Law. Samantha will share her insights on the recent litigation at the University of California, Berkeley, brought by the Brandeis Center, alleging anti-Semitism, as well as her personal experiences with anti-Semitism at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. In an epilogue to that interview, I'll be sharing my thoughts on the rise of anti-Semitism, along with the recent developments regarding the University of Florida system's decision to eliminate DEI positions. As we roll out today's episode, it's important to note that we're recording this immediately following Super Tuesday. In the aftermath, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has suspended her presidential campaign, leaving Joe Biden and Donald Trump as the two major political party nominees. We'll certainly have much more to say about this as the campaign unfolds. So buckle up, listeners. We've got a lot of ground to cover in this episode. Let's ride. Welcome back to the Modern Federalist. In this episode, we're honored to have a distinguished guest with us, Mr. Zach Smith. Zach is a senior legal fellow and manager of the Supreme Court Appellate Advocacy Program in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to our discussion today, having spent his entire career at the intersection of law and public policy. Zach's work focuses on the Constitution, the rule of law, and the proper role of the judiciary in our system of federalism. His insights and analysis are widely sought after, so please join me in welcoming Mr. Zach Smith to the Modern Federalist. Let's dive into our conversation. Thank you, Zach, for joining us on the Modern Federalist today.
Of course, happy to be with you.
Now, you are a legal expert and a former prosecutor that has been following the New York civil fraud case against Donald Trump and his company. Can you give us a brief overview of what this case is about, what the judge ruled?
Yeah, look, I think before we get into the details of the case, it's important to take a step back and put this case in context. You know, Donald Trump is facing several criminal trials, one in Manhattan being brought by Alvin Bragg there, one in Georgia being brought by the Fulton County DA, Fannie Willis, and then two federal cases, one in Washington, D.C., one in Florida being brought by special counsel Jack Smith. This case is a little bit different because the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, is not asking for Donald Trump or his companies to face criminal penalties to be put in jail. She's asking for them to face civil fines. This is a civil case, and so there's no possibility that Trump or anyone in his organizations would face jail time as a result of this particular case. Now, with that being said, when Letitia James brought the case, she made clear she was going to ask for a record-setting fine to be imposed against Donald Trump and his company. She was asking for the judge to impose a $370 million fine, in addition to some other restrictions on his ability to do business in the state of New York. And as we found out last week, she got pretty close to that request. The judge imposed a $355 million $1 billion fine when Donald Trump imposed additional fines on both of his sons, Don Jr. and Eric, in addition to some other individuals associated with the Trump Organization, essentially barred Donald Trump from doing business in the state of New York for several years and placed his companies under the control of a court-appointed monitor. And so this is an unprecedented decision in a lot of ways. The fine amount alone is eye-popping. I think it's given a lot of people pause to see that. But this story isn't quite done yet because Donald Trump has pledged to appeal this decision. And so I suspect we'll be hearing much more about it in the coming weeks and months.
You've already addressed this to some extent, but how do you assess the severity and the fairness of these sanctions, particularly in New York State and also in other jurisdictions?
Well, the New York law that Letitia James brought this case under is somewhat unique. It doesn't require her to prove that Donald Trump intended to defraud anyone. It doesn't require her to prove that anyone was in fact defrauded as a result of Donald Trump's conduct. And in fact, if you listen to the testimony that came out during the trial, the banks who were counterparties to many of these loans where supposedly fraudulent information was given said they did not lose money as a result of doing business with Donald Trump, and they were happy to continue doing business with him for future transactions. And these banks are very sophisticated counterparties. They do high dollar, high risk transactions all of the time. And so to hear them say that essentially they weren't harmed in any way by this allegedly fraudulent conduct, I think was very telling. And yet this record-setting fine of $355 million was imposed where essentially no victims were identified. And so because of that, again, I think that's given a lot of people pause. And as some have rightly speculated, I suspect this may give some individuals and companies pause about doing business in the state of New York in the future.
It should under these circumstances. And I recall fairly quickly after the verdict was announced or the amount of the judgment was announced, the governor of New York, who is a stalwart Democrat, came out and said that companies should not be concerned about doing business in the state of New York over this judgment, but they would be wise to reconsider doing business with the state of New York, in my view.
Well, no, I was just going to say that's absolutely right. And I think her statement really should provide cold comfort to many of the companies who are currently doing business in the state of New York or companies that are considering doing business in the state of New York. The way this particular law is written is so broad that any company could theoretically be targeted under it for potential fraud. And what's particularly problematic is you essentially had Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, campaigning on a pledge to, quote, get Donald Trump or something to that effect, basically promising to go after Donald Trump and his companies. And I think the partisan nature of this lawsuit in particular was really highlighted by Letitia James' conduct after the judgment was entered by the judge. Now, keep in mind, the judge from the outset said that he found that Trump and his companies had committed fraud. And so all of the testimony, all of the evidence at the 2.5 month long or so trial was about how much of a fine he would impose. Well, Letitia James came out and said that if Donald Trump didn't pay the fine, she'd seize his property, seize Trump Tower, things of that nature. But there's been no indication that Donald Trump isn't going to pay the fine. And in fact, if he appeals, like he said he will, he has to either pay the money into the court register or put up a bond while he appeals. And so her comments were really out of place, inappropriate, I think. And I think, again, highlight really the partisan nature of this lawsuit.
That really, in my view, should give everyone pause, because if you take Donald Trump's name out of this, how can this be justice when you have a situation where none of the lenders and financial institutions involved are parties to the action and are asking for judgment to replenish their coffers? Instead, it is the state. And what does it say about the state of free enterprise and the state of New York under these circumstances?
Well, unfortunately, not much good. I would think. You know, and again, I think it highlights, but it's highlighted by the fact that Letitia James campaigned on a promise to go after Trump and his companies. The judge from the outset was, said that he found that fraud was committed. It was really just a matter of how much of a fine he was going to impose. In his 92-page opinion, he took some very personal shots at Donald Trump and others who testified on his behalf. And so again, from top to bottom, this is just a very troubling proceeding. But it really becomes even more troubling when, again, you look at the other criminal cases that Donald Trump is facing, particularly the New York criminal case that has been brought by the rogue district attorney, Alvin Bragg, in Manhattan. Alvin Bragg campaigned on a promise not to prosecute most misdemeanor offenses. He campaigned to try to divert even most felony offenses, even violent felony offenses. And I think we've seen and heard a lot of news stories talking about the problematic consequences of those policies. And yet, when it comes to Donald Trump, not only did he too campaign on a promise of essentially pledging to prosecute Donald Trump, but the theory he's pursuing against Donald Trump for the hush money payments he made to Stormy Daniels, it's a very novel, very untested legal theory where essentially he's trying to bootstrap what would ordinarily be misdemeanor offenses, bootstrap those into felony offenses in order to avoid some statute of limitations issues. And so again, top to bottom, both of these cases, the civil case being brought by the New York Attorney General, the criminal case in New York being brought by the rogue Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, are very troubling. And I think to your point, I think any reasonable person looking at these two cases would likely conclude that they would not have been brought if the defendant's name was not Donald Trump.
Indeed, and it really speaks to the efforts to weaponize the legal process and the judiciary, and that should give all Americans pause, in my view.
No, absolutely. You know, somewhere along the way, so many on the left have lost sight that equal treatment under the law is supposed to be a bedrock principle of our society. We routinely afford due process. We provide counsel to people who are accused of committing even very heinous, unspeakable crime, because that's what our Constitution requires, and that's what we as the American people have decided is appropriate. When you're accused of a crime, everyone is entitled to due process. Unfortunately, many on the left seem willing to discard those basic notions of fairness and due process and associated ideas when it comes to Donald Trump and others who have worked on his behalf, either in government or on the campaign trail. And that is a very bad thing for us as a country and a very dangerous thing for us as a country.
What, in your opinion, are the chances of Mr. Trump succeeding in his appeal at the appellate courts of the state of New York?
Well, I joke, you know, over the past few months and the past year or so, my crystal ball is broken because there's so much happening. But look, you know, I think there are some very real issues he can raise on appeal. I suspect his lawyers are already looking at many of those issues. But if we look at who is currently sitting on the New York Court of Appeals, that's their state's equivalent of a Supreme Court, just has a little bit of a different name. Each member of that court was appointed by a Democratic governor, either the current governor, Kathy Hochul, or her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo. And so that doesn't mean necessarily that they won't rule in favor of Donald Trump on appeal, but it certainly does indicate that he may face somewhat of an uphill battle raising this appeal. But we'll have to wait and see. And again, I suspect his legal team is already hard at work crafting the arguments that they are going to make on appeal.
Another question I have is, assuming that at some point Mr. Trump, either voluntarily or after he runs out his appeals, based upon an execution and levy on the judgment, where does this money go?
It goes to the state of New York. At least that's my understanding. And that's, again, part of what strikes people as being so odd about this case, the fact that there's just no identifiable victim. You know, typically, if you, receive a fine or forfeiture order, all or some of that money, a good portion of it, will typically be used to make victims whole. But since there are no identifiable victims in this case, the money just goes to the state of New York. And I think it's also important to realize, you know, one of the issues that Donald Trump is likely to face as he's taking this case up on appeal is that he has to put up, as I mentioned earlier, either pay the money into the court register or put up an appeal bond. And given the size of the judgment in this case, that is not a small chunk of change that he has to come up with, particularly when you're considering he's also facing judgments in the defamation lawsuit that recently took place in the state of New York as well. And some of the other criminal cases he's facing, he certainly is under a lot of pressure, both legally and financially right now.
Zach, what are your thoughts on the role and the authority of the monitor that the judge appointed to oversee all the Trump-related business operations in New York State?
Yeah, so I haven't looked closely at her role, but essentially the idea is that she will be overseeing the operations of the Trump Organization, that in order to take certain transactions, they would have to get her approval. She could potentially even make some decisions on her own for the Trump Organization. And so again, it essentially has, if this order stands up and is not overturned on appeal, it would essentially take, control of the company away from Donald Trump and others in his organization or his family, and place, very large authority in the hands of this court-appointed monitor, which, again, I think many people find very troubling, particularly given the types of allegations being raised in this case and the lack of identifiable victims and all the things we've been talking about so far.
Exactly. When you have a government-appointed monitor inserted into financial decisions that not only impact Mr. Trump and the other shareholders of his organization, but also lenders, that's just creating, in my view, a quagmire that the government should not be involved in.
Well, and typically you see court-appointed monitors, some type of, receiver appointed in bankruptcy cases, maybe if there's some type of insolvency issue, or if there are very real allegations, allegations of fraud where the company is insolvent, can't make all the victims whole, that type of thing. Those are instances where courts have appointed monitors to step in, kind of marshal the assets, make sure they're, implementing an orderly resolution of the company or an orderly implementation of the court's order. Particularly in the bankruptcy context, this is not uncommon to happen. But again, in this particular case, with these types of allegations, with all of the money going to the state of New York as a result of this trial and the judgment against Trump and his companies, that is what people, I think, find so troubling.
Especially since it's not in the context of a receivership or a bankruptcy, at least at this point of the process.
Right.
Finally, Zach, what are some of the broader lessons and takeaways from this case for our listeners who care about the truth and the integrity of our political and legal system?
Well, I think there are troubling takeaways, to be perfectly honest with you. We've been talking a lot over the past few years. I've been talking a lot about the appearance, if not the reality, of a double standard of justice that applies in our country. And if you look at the prosecutions that have been brought against Donald Trump, others who represented him in various actions, and compare that to what happens when folks on the left are accused of breaking the law, like Hunter Biden, like some of the attorneys involved in the Russia-Trump collusion hoax investigation, they receive slaps on the wrist or just a pass from the Justice Department or other state authorities. And so this weaponization of our political legal system to accomplish political goals, this double standard of justice, that is something that should trouble all Americans, regardless of whether you're Republican, Democrat, independent, what have you. We should all want and expect equal justice under the law. And I think that's something we need to do a better job of refocusing on. But unfortunately, too many on the left are willing to go along with these types of politically motivated prosecutions.
That's very well said, Zach. If any of my friends on the left are listening to this particular episode, I would encourage you to think what would happen if the shoe was on the other foot. There are plenty of attorney generals who could very well go after a Democrat president in this manner, and that wouldn't be justice either if it's not based upon actual facts and actual victims.
Right. Absolutely.
Thank you, Zach, for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation.
The Modern Federalist, hosted by Charlton Allen, will return in a moment.
Well, howdy there, partner. Listen up. I got something to tell you. There's a new sheriff in town. It goes by the name of the Modern Federalist. hosted by Charlton Allen. It's the straight shooting, truth telling podcast you've been waiting for. So saddle up and join us on this ride.
This is the Modern Federalist Podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen.
In this segment, I want to jump headfirst into a recent Supreme Court decision that has significant implications for our republic. I'm speaking of the case of Trump versus Anderson. The case revolves around former President Donald J. Trump's eligibility to run for office again. A group of Colorado voters contended that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment prohibits Trump from holding the presidency. The Colorado Supreme Court agreed by a 4-3 vote, ordering the state to exclude Trump from the Republican primary ballot and disregard any write-in votes cast for him. However, the United States Supreme Court has intervened, unanimously reversing that decision. The per curiam opinion, which represents the judgment of the court, held that the Constitution makes Congress and not the states responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates. This decision underscores the principle of federalism, emphasizing that it is Congress's role to enforce the 14th Amendment and not that of the respective states. Justice Barrett, in a separate concurrence, took a more restrained approach. While she agreed that the states lack the power to enforce Section 3 against presidential candidates, she suggested that the court should not have decided anything more than that. This perspective highlights the importance, in her view, of judicial restraint and the avoidance of overreach. On the other hand, Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson, penned a concurrence that was apparently originally drafted as a partial dissent. They agreed with the judgment of the court, but expressed concern about the majority's interpretation of congressional power. This concurrence underscores the ongoing debate within the court about the balance of power between the states and the federal government. Interestingly, metadata suggests that the concurrence by the three liberal justices may have been originally drafted as a concurrence in part and a dissent in part. As a former statewide judicial officer, I understand that this metadata trail may be an intentional signal or an unfortunate editorial slip. This is a reminder that the process of reaching a decision, particularly a decision reached by a panel of different individuals with different perspectives, can be complex and nuanced, and not always as tidy as it may seem. Now let's turn to the political implications of this ruling. Our distinguished podcast guest, John Malcolm, projected the unanimous result in Episode 4. Despite this, Democrats in Congress are suggesting now that they will move forward with legislation to disqualify Trump from the ballot all the same. But perhaps it's time for the politicians of Washington, and elsewhere for that matter, to take a step back from all the partisan machinations and simply allow the American people to make the ultimate decision here. If we truly want to, quote, protect democracy, end quote, how can one proceed to disenfranchise a substantial segment of the population from casting a ballot for their candidate of choice? That action just cannot be squared with the desired outcome of the progressive left. Moreover, if successful, it will lead to the supporters of President Trump and future politicians attempting to exact the same result. At some point, the adults in the room need to say, let this decision be made by the American people at the ballot box of a fair and free election, and not by politicians. After all, we've already heard from 9 adults in the room, namely a unanimous Supreme Court. Welcome back to The Modern Federalist. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today we're diving into an issue that is not only important, but also deeply personal to many across the country. We're honored to have a special guest with us, Samantha Crane. Samantha is more than just a casual observer of the conversations at the front lines of law and justice. She's actively participating in shaping them. Currently serving as the Vice President of the Federalist Society at the University of Wisconsin School of Law, Samantha is no stranger to Madison. A proud alumna, she holds an undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. But today, Samantha joins us for a slightly different reason. She's penned several urgent and thought-provoking articles addressing the disturbing surge in anti-Semitism, an issue that has triggered litigation at the University of California at Berkeley. Adding depth and context to Samantha's perspective are her personal encounters with anti-Semitism at the University of Wisconsin. Her firsthand experience lends her writing a certain edge. It's real, and it's incredibly relevant for us today. So plug in your headphones, turn up the volume, and join us as we explore the rise of anti-Semitism on university campuses and learn more about the journey of Samantha Crank. Let's dive into our conversation. Samantha, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Could you please introduce yourself to our audience and share a bit about your background and your work with the Federalist Society?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Samantha. I'm originally from Northbrook, Illinois. I am currently a 2L at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and I am the vice president of the Wisconsin Law School Federalist Society student chapter. And I'm also a member of the Federalist Society's civil rights practice group. I'm a student liaison for them.
Samantha, you've written extensively about the growth of anti-Semitism on college campuses. Can you provide an overview of this issue, why it's important for people to understand today?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously today, anti-Semitism is getting more attention in the mainstream media and online than maybe it has in the past, given the events of October 7th. But anti-Semitism is nothing new. You know, this is an age-old problem. We can look back throughout history and see countless examples, you know, going back to the 1930s and 40s during World War II and the Holocaust, but even further dating back to the Greeks and Romans. And, you know, it just kind of recycles in different formats. And today we're looking at kind of the current model and people cut Israel as a way to launch different forms of anti-Semitic attacks, both on college campuses and across the country.
And you've had firsthand experience with anti-Semitism at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Could you share some of your experiences and how they've shaped your perspective on this issue?
Yeah, so it's been pretty surreal, honestly. You know, post-October 7th, just a couple of days later, I was walking back from class on the phone with my mom, and I see a group of students in the middle of campus chanting, you know, glory to the murderers. And it's, you know, pretty unbelievable to be seeing this in modern time and kind of seeing where people who claim to have this like progressive ideology to the point where they're now supporting terrorist acts is pretty alarming to see. So it's very disheartening. You know, college campuses used to be kind of centers of, you know, where people could come together and have this free exchange of ideas. And unfortunately, it's kind of seeming like in today's current climate, things are moving away from that.
And you have also written an article about the Brandeis Center's lawsuit against the University of California at Berkeley, where you discussed allegations of a hostile environment for Jewish students. Could you elaborate on these allegations and the university's response?
Yeah, so in that article, I talked about the Brandeis Center's lawsuits, their lawsuit against UC Berkeley for violations of the Equal Protection Clause, Free Exercise Clause, and violation of Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what's been going on at Berkeley seems like there's been trends, various incidents of anti-Semitism, both before and after October 7th. So it will be interesting to see what kind of comes of this. I know just about 2 weeks ago, it looked like UC Berkeley filed a motion to dismiss for claiming, you know, all these activities were protected under the First Amendment. So it will be interesting to see where this kind of goes from here.
You've talked a little bit about this particular component, but want to dive a little deeper. How has the October 2023 Hamas terrorist attack on Israel influenced the climate on college campuses for Jewish students?
Yeah, obviously, I can't speak on behalf of all Jewish students, but I can speak on behalf of my own experience as a Jewish law student here. And I also went to University of Wisconsin for undergrad, so I'm pretty familiar with this campus. And this is the first time in, now I've been here, this is my seventh year at UW between undergrad and law school. And this is the first time I've really felt a strong disconnect from my campus, from a lot of my classmates, unfortunately. It's been difficult when it seems like most of the world is either kind of ignoring what seems to be going on or just refuses to acknowledge it or is adverse to even, you know, what's been going on in this during this conflict. And it's really been disappointing. You know, response from administration has also been very lackluster and minimal, which is also disappointing when you see other schools where, that have, you know, a little bit different kinds of leadership. In one article, I mentioned that University of Florida, you know, their university president was very forward and saying, you know, we are so proud to have Jewish students at our school. They have one of the biggest Jewish student populations. And they're like, you can do whatever you want for the most part under the First Amendment, but, you know, we're still going to protect our Jewish students. And we just haven't received similar messaging from the administration here, which has been really disappointing.
And along those lines, can you describe what has made the response from University of Wisconsin so lackluster to these acts and incidents of anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's only so much to say when a lot of the, you know, things that they're doing is a lack of what they're doing. You know, we see protests for months. There have been protests post October 7th of people rallying in support of Hamas, which is like pretty hard to comprehend. And obviously, a lot of these acts are protected under the First Amendment. And I am, you know, all for freedom of speech. At the same time, you know, it would be comforting to hear from the university, you know, obviously these students can say these things, but, you know, we don't support those things. And we just haven't, heard any of that kind of discussion or rhetoric coming from either, you know, the greater university or the law school administration.
So it sounds like one of the takeaways is it's really hard to describe silence. And what is really lacking is any articulation that Jewish students are supported and embraced and a vital part of the university community. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would say it is. And this is no small Jewish community. There are 5,000 Jewish undergraduates at this school. So that doesn't include any of the graduate schools, but that is a pretty large number of Jewish students, given the percentage of students at this university. It's a large university with a large Jewish student population. And I would say, yeah, that's a pretty fair assessment, unfortunately.
We've kind of already touched upon this, but what are some of the challenges in addressing anti-Semitism on college campuses when you have to stay within the confines of the First Amendment and allowing free speech, but also recognizing the traditional notion that your rights end where someone else's rights begin?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's going on here is the university doesn't want to seem like they're, you know, favoring one side over the other. And you can see in the kinds of statements that the university has put out, you know, surrounding the events of October 7th. And even going forward, they've continued to make a few messages here and there to the school. And what's unfortunate is they don't, I think there's a lack of understanding of like what is at the core of these issues. I think education is a really important component of all of this. And they've tried to kind of push it off as like, this is a political issue. But when the reality is October 7th was a terrorist attack, and not giving it that acknowledgement is really problematic. So I think just kind of like adjusting the rhetoric and realize, you know, what are we dealing with here is extremely important and could really help kind of shift the climate and discussion around these things. Obviously, the university's not, you know, can't step in and, you know, tell people to stop saying certain things. And I wouldn't want that. You know, we need to meet, you know, any sort of speech that we disagree with just with more speech. But I think, you know, shifting the conversation is something that can actually be done.
That sounds like a reasonable approach to me. Lastly, is there anything else that we need to know about this issue? And what are your key takeaways for our listeners?
Yeah, so I think some key takeaways are in this issue that we see discussing anti-Semitism, people, I think a lot of times don't fully understand what it means to be anti-Semitic or, you know, saying things that are anti-Semitic or acting in these ways. And I think it's okay to just be honest and say, you know, I don't fully understand this issue. Like, I need to learn more. And I think being a little bit more honest than just immediately trying to kind of go, you know, with along with what everyone else is saying. I think, you know, try to just say, you know what, I'm going to take a step back and learn a little bit more about this before I jump on the bandwagon. I think that's extremely important. Asking a lot of questions, trying to educate yourself, I think is extremely important here. And just take a step back and see where that gets you before, like I said, just going along with everyone else. I think people will be surprised in what they learn.
And it's probably one of those things that, from my perspective, if people understood what some of the rhetoric that has been employed actually means, for instance, when your pro-Palestinian protesters say from the river to the sea, that is a statement that is made for someone who's woefully ignorant of the historical and the geographic and the cultural impact of that. They may not understand, but it is basically calling for, at best, the expulsion of millions of people from their homeland. I think if people understood what some of the rhetoric being employed by the pro-Palestinian groups actually means, they would have a change of heart. Do you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we'll go one step further and saying, you know, that statement is really calling for the genocide of Jews. I mean, if people are kicked out, and there's no homeland for the Jewish people. I mean, we've seen what happened, like we mentioned at the beginning of this, you know, time and time again, Jews have been constantly persecuted throughout history. And that is a large part of the reason why Israel exists and why Jewish people who don't even live in Israel need Israel to exist. And I don't think people understand that. Like you said, there's a big gap in people's historical understanding these issues that really needs to be kind of fixed to an extent.
I understand. I was probably being far too generous and diplomatic. I think it's fair to say that there are some on the other side of that debate that are calling for genocide. And that is just heartrending to think that people would still have, you know, such bigotry in the 21st century. But here we are.
Yeah, it is a wild time to
do it. Well, thank you so much, Samantha, for bringing attention to these important issues and the articles you've written. I will have them linked in our show notes for listeners to read and learn more about. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
At the conclusion of this thought-provoking interview with Samantha Crane, who shared her experiences and insights on the pressing issue of anti-Semitism on America's college campuses, I wanted to share a few thoughts as we go forward. We're going to continue our examination of this pervasive anti-Semitism existing on America's college campuses. Samantha reported on the disturbing rise of anti-Semitism at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Wisconsin, both of which are well-known bastions of liberalism and heavily invested in diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, initiatives. Yet these universities and the media seem to be turning a blind eye to calls for the elimination of Israel and the Israeli people, which are at worst calls for their genocide that are occurring on these campuses and other campuses throughout our great nation. The irony here is palpable. These institutions, which champion DEI, are failing to protect their Jewish students from outright hate and discrimination. This raises serious questions about what the DEI narrative truly represents. In stark contrast, Samantha points to the University of Florida as a model of tolerance and civility. Despite the progressive left and their media allies criticizing that university system for eliminating DEI, Florida stands out for its support of Jewish students. This is a telling example of the real-life difference between the woke view of diversity and a more conservative view that accepts and supports true diversity of thought and viewpoints. The progressive left's view seems to be more of a politically charged narrative, while the conservative view emphasizes the importance of individual rights, freedom of thought, and genuine inclusivity. As we wrap up this segment, let's remember that true diversity and inclusion means respecting and protecting all voices, even when they challenge your views or the prevailing narrative. It's time for the adults in the room to say, let's uphold the principles of a fair and free society, not just in our words, but in our actions.
In the spirit of Thomas Paine, we ignite the torch of reason.
You are listening to The Modern Federalist.
As we enter the final moments of this episode, I find solace in the timeless wisdom of Oliver Wendell Holmes. One flag, one land, one heart, one hand, one nation, evermore. In the face of division and discord, let us as Americans rally around a renewed sense of unity and purpose. Let us stand firm in our principles, guided by the belief in a shared destiny and a nation indivisible, once more, evermore. I extend my deepest gratitude to our esteemed guests, Zach Smith at the Heritage Foundation and Samantha Crane at the University of Wisconsin Federalist Society, for enriching our discussion with their perspectives and insights. As we conclude today's dialogue, let us commit to upholding American values and fostering a climate of unity and understanding evermore. Stay tuned for more thought-provoking conversations on the Modern Federalist Podcast. I'm Charlton Allen, signing off until we meet again.
Thanks for tuning in to The Modern Federalist. Don't forget to subscribe for more thought-provoking episodes. Until next time.